There was a Benjaminite, a man of standing, whose name was Kish, son of Abiel, the son of Zeror, the son of Bechorah, the son of Aphia of Benjamin. He had a son named Saul, an impressive young man without equal among the Israelites, a head taller than any of the others. Now the donkeys belonging to Saul's father Kish were lost, and Kish said to his son Saul, "Take one of the servants with you and go and look for the donkeys." So he passed through the hill country of Ephraim and through the area around Shalisha, but they did not find them. They went on into the district of Shalem, but the donkeys were not there. Then he passed through the territory of Benjamin, but they did not find them. When they reached the district of Zuph, Saul said to the servant who was with him, "Come, let's go back, or my father will stop worrying about the donkeys and start worrying about us." But the servant replied, "Look, in this town there is a man of God. He is highly respected, and everything he says comes true. Let's go there now. Perhaps he will tell us what way to take." Saul said to his servant, "If we go, what can we give the man? The food in our sacks is gone. We have no gift to take to the man of God. What do we have?" The servant answered him again. "Look," he said, "I have a quarter of a shekel of silver. I will give it to the man of God so that he will tell us what way to take." Formerly in Israel, if a man went to inquire of God, he would say, "Come, let us go to the seer," because the prophet of today used to be called a seer. "Good," Saul said to his servant. "Come, let's go." So they set out for the town where the man of God was. As they were going up the hill to the town, they met some girls coming out to draw water, and they asked them, "Is the seer here?" "He is," they answered. "He's ahead of you. Hurry now. He has just come to our town today, for the people have a sacrifice at the high place. As soon as you enter the town, you will find him before he goes up to the high place to eat. The people will not begin eating until he comes, because he must bless the sacrifice. Afterwards, those who are invited will eat. Go up now, and you should find him about this time." They went up to the town as they were entering it, there was Samuel coming towards them on his way up to the high place. Now the day before Saul came, the Lord had revealed this to Samuel. "About this time tomorrow, I will send you a man from the land of Benjamin. Anoint him leader over my people Israel. He will deliver my people from the hand of the Philistines. I have looked upon my people, for their cry has reached me." When Samuel caught sight of Saul, the Lord said to him, "This is the man I spoke to you about. He will govern my people." Saul approached Samuel in the gateway and asked, "Would you please tell me where the seer's house is?" "I am the seer," Samuel replied. "Go up ahead of me to the high place, for today you are to eat with me. And in the morning, I will let you go and will tell you all that is in your heart. As for the donkeys you lost 3 days ago, do not worry about them. They have been found. And to whom is all the desire of Israel turned, if not to you and all your father's family?" Saul answered, "But am I not a Benjaminite, from the smallest tribe of Israel? And is not my clan the least of all the clans of the tribe of Benjamin? Why do you say such a thing to me?" Then Samuel brought Saul and his servant into the hall and seated them at the head of those who were invited, about 30 in number. Samuel said to the cook, "Bring the piece of meat I gave you, the one I told you to lay aside." So the cook took up the leg with what was on it and set it in front of Saul. Samuel said, "Here is what has been kept for you. Eat, because it was set aside for you for this occasion from the time I said, I have invited guests. And Saul dined with Samuel that day.
Verse 17. Samuel summoned the people of Israel to the Lord at Mizpah and said to them, this is what the Lord, the God of Israel, says. I brought Israel up out of Egypt and delivered you from the power of Egypt and all the kingdoms that oppressed you. But you have now rejected your God who saves you out of all your calamities and distresses. And you have said, no, set a king over us. So now present yourselves before the Lord by your tribes and clans. When Samuel brought all the tribes of Israel near, the tribe of Benjamin was chosen. Then he brought forward the tribe of Benjamin, clan by clan, and Matri's clan was chosen. Finally, Saul, son of Kish, was chosen. But when they looked for him, he was not to be found. So they inquired further of the Lord, has the man come here yet? And the Lord said, yes, he has hidden himself among the baggage. They ran and brought him out. And as he stood among the people, he was a head taller than any of the others. Samuel said to all the people, do you see the man the Lord has chosen? There is no one like him among all the people. Then the people shouted, long live the king! Samuel explained to the people the regulations of the kingship. He wrote them down on a scroll and deposited it before the Lord. Then Samuel dismissed the people, each to his own home. Saul also went to his home in Gibeah, accompanied by valiant men whose hearts God had touched. But some troublemakers said, how can this man save us? They despised him and brought him no gifts. But Saul kept silent. Nahash the Ammonite went up and besieged Jabesh Gilead. And all the men of Jabesh said to him, make a treaty with us and we will be subject to you. But Nahash the Ammonite replied, I will make a treaty with you only on the condition that I gouge out the right eye of every one of you and so bring disgrace on all Israel. The elders of Jabesh said to him, give us 7 days so that we can send messengers throughout Israel. If no one comes to rescue us, we will surrender to you. When the messengers came to Gibeah of Saul and reported these terms to the people, they all wept aloud. Just then, Saul was returning from the fields behind his oxen, and he asked, what is wrong with the people? Why are they weeping? Then they repeated to him what the men of Jabesh had said. When Saul heard these words, the Spirit of God came upon him in power, and he burned with anger. He took a pair of oxen, cut them into pieces, and sent them pieces by messengers throughout Israel, proclaiming, this is what will be done to the oxen of anyone who does not follow Saul and Samuel. Then the terror of the Lord fell on the people, and they turned out as one man. When Saul mustered them at Bezek, the men of Israel numbered 300,000, and the men of Judah 30,000. They told the messengers who had come, say to the men of Jabesh Gilead, by the time the sun is hot tomorrow, you will be delivered. When the messengers went and reported this to the men of Jabesh, they were elated. They said to the Ammonites, tomorrow we will surrender to you, and you can do to us whatever seems good to you. The next day Saul separated his men into three divisions. During the last watch of the night they broke into the camp of the Ammonites and slaughtered them until the heat of the day. Those who survived were scattered, so that no two of them were left together. The people then said to Samuel, who was it that asked, shall Saul reign over us? Bring these men to us and we will put them to death. But Saul said, "No one shall be put to death today, for this day the Lord has rescued Israel." Then Samuel said to the people, "Come, let us go to Gilgal and there reaffirm the kingship." So all the people went to Gilgal and confirmed Saul as king in the presence of the Lord. There they sacrificed fellowship offerings before the Lord, and Saul and all the Israelites held a great celebration.
Many people live with no big purpose to life, no overarching goal or direction to their lives. Sure, they would want themselves and their loved ones, their families, to be happy and content, but life is just one day after the next. There is no big vision or direction that shapes their lives. Perhaps that's because there are so many uncertainties, so many unknowns. How can there be a grand design, a big purpose for the whole of life? And that's not just a modern experience. It was, I suspect, true for the woman we meet here this morning. Hardened by the hurts in life she had known, it had become a means of self-protection, if she wasn't really too bothered about where life was heading. That was until she met a stranger who asked her of all people, for a drink. Jesus is traveling with his disciples through Samaria. When they reach the town, the disciples go to get something to eat. Jesus, tired and weary at the middle of the day, sits down by the well. He has no bucket, but when this woman approaches, he asks for a drink. Nothing unusual about that, we might think. But it is. By starting this conversation, Jesus is doing something very unusual. She is shocked that he is even speaking to her because, as John explains, verse 9, Jews do not associate with Samaritans. That's a bit of an understatement. They were bitter enemies. Centuries before, the Jews in the area had intermarried with the surrounding tribes and formed a new tribe, the Samaritans. They took bits of the local religion too. So the Jews now regarded the Samaritans not only as mixed race, but as heretics too, unfaithful to the Lord. That's the first reason why this woman is surprised. Jesus is even speaking to her. On top of that, it was considered scandalous for a Jewish man to be speaking to an unknown woman in public. Jesus is breaking through that barrier as well. What's more, she has come to draw water at the middle of the day. It was normally done first thing in the morning, before it got too hot, with water for the household chores of the day. So why was this woman here, alone, in the middle of the day? The answer is that she was a moral outcast, an outsider, even in her own community. She went alone to avoid the snubs and sneers of the other women. As we discover later, she'd had several partners. She was a lady with a shady past, a reject, even among the rejects. So when Jesus begins to speak to her, he is deliberately, knowingly, reaching across almost every barrier that we human beings put between ourselves. The racial barrier, the cultural barrier, the gender barrier, the moral barrier. Every convention of the time which said that he, a religious Jewish male, should have nothing to do with such a woman. But Jesus doesn't care about such obstacles. Do you see how shocking that is? He reaches right across all the human divides in order to connect to her. The mission of Jesus is radically inclusive. It's no accident that this story follows on from that of Nicodemus, who we met a couple of weeks ago. He was a Jewish male. She is a Samaritan woman. He was the theological expert. She is an uneducated villager. Where he was morally upright and religiously orthodox, she is morally and religiously suspect. The contrast could not be greater. Yet Jesus engages with both of them and everybody in between. The mission of Jesus is radically inclusive. I wonder if we as a church are anywhere near as radical in who we invite into our lives, in the friendships we make. And if you're someone who our society says is not worth very much, perhaps because of the job or the money or the possessions you don't have, even simply that you are a woman, if you're left with a low self-image, then please know that Jesus doesn't think like that. Jesus is interested in you, very interested. The next thing to notice about this encounter is that although Jesus is clearly open and warm towards her and speaks to her with great gentleness, in contrast to how he spoke to Nicodemus, he still confronts her. He does so in a gentle and artful way. He is a model of tact and discretion, but he is ready to address the emptiness in this woman's life. He begins by saying, verse 10, "If you knew the gift of God and who it is that asks you for a drink, you would have asked him, and he would have given you living water." Something that she then misunderstands, that she takes Jesus' words about living water literally. I'm not so sure. I rather think she knows Jesus is playing word games, and with a glint in her eye, she decides to play along. "You haven't even got a bucket for this living water. Is this well that was good enough for our ancestors not good enough for you?" But Jesus is not easily diverted from his purpose. Verse 13, "Everyone who drinks this water will be thirsty again. But whoever drinks the water I give him will never thirst. Indeed, the water I give him will become in him a spring of water welling up to eternal life." The picture is a little lost on us. We only have to turn on a tap for fresh drinking water. Most of us have never known real thirst, unlike this semi-desert area. Because our bodies normally contain so much water, real thirst is absolute agony. And to taste water after that, well, it is about the most satisfying experience you can ever know. So what is Jesus saying to this outsider? He's saying, "I've got something for you which is as basic and necessary for you spiritually as water is for you physically. Something without which you are absolutely dehydrated, absolutely shriveled." And this metaphor of living water says even more. Jesus is not just telling us what he has to offer is life-saving. It is that without Jesus we are spiritually dead. But he's also saying that what he offers satisfies from the inside. "My water," he says, "if you get it, will become in you a spring of water welling up to eternal life." He's talking about satisfaction deep within, soul satisfaction. Satisfaction and contentment that does not depend on what is happening outside of us or round about us. If we ask, what is the secret of real happiness? Almost always people will answer by thinking of something outside of themselves. For this woman, it seems that she had set her hope on a loving relationship, only to be repeatedly let down. Others set their hopes on family. Some on career, some on money and what it will do. If I have that, if I get them, if I move there, then I will know that life is meaningful. Then I will have significance and security. It's almost always something outside of themselves. But Jesus' metaphor said there is nothing outside of us that can truly satisfy the thirst that is deep down inside. To continue the metaphor, it's not going to be something you splash on from the outside. It's going to be something happening within, deeper than the thirst itself. Here is Jesus saying, I can give it. I can give what will bring satisfaction at the core of your being, regardless of what happens outside and around you, regardless of circumstance. Now, something gets in the way of us hearing what Jesus is saying. And I think it's because most of us don't recognize that soul thirst, that inner longing for what it is. See, as long as you think there's a pretty good chance you'll achieve some of your dreams, then you will experience that inner emptiness as drive or ambition. And so a person can remain almost unaware of how deep that thirst really is. They keep on telling themselves that satisfaction is just around the corner. Just that next thing, that next job, that next relationship, that next hobby. And as a result, they go through the whole of their lives without ever acknowledging their real spiritual thirst. The author, C.S. Lewis, talked about the same thing when he said, "We are half-hearted creatures, fooling about with drink and sex and ambition, when infinite joy is offered us. Like an ignorant child who wants to go on making mud pies in a slum, because he cannot imagine what is meant by the offer of a holiday by the sea. We are far too easily pleased." And that's why the few people who do reach their dreams are shocked to discover that they fail to satisfy. Boris Becker said, "I had won Wimbledon twice, once as the youngest player ever. I was rich. I had all the material possessions I needed, but I had no inner peace." He got all those things which we think will make us happy, only to find that they didn't satisfy his thirst in the slightest. Sophia Loren, in a well-known interview at the height of her fame, said she had everything, awards, marriage, and so on, but that in my life there is an emptiness that is impossible to fulfill. Here is Jesus saying that if a person lives for something other than him, it will fail them. It will let them down. For one thing, they'll be enslaved by it. It will tell them that they have to have it, or there'll be no tomorrow. If anything threatens it, they feel as if life is falling apart. And if they do achieve it, then it won't actually deliver the satisfaction they expect. The American writer David Foster Wallace, not a religious man, said this: "Everybody worships. The only choice we get is what to worship. And the compelling reason for maybe choosing some sort of God to worship is that pretty much everything else you worship will eat you alive. If you worship money and things, then you will never have enough, never feel you have enough. Worship your own body and beauty and sexual allure, and you'll always feel ugly. Worship power, and you'll end up feeling weak and afraid, needing ever more power over others to numb you to your own fear. A person might never call it worship, but they will. Whatever is number one in their lives. And Jesus says, unless I'm the center of your life, unless you quench your spiritual thirst in me, then whatever you worship will abandon you in the end. I said we often miss how thirsty we are because we believe we can fulfill our dreams. And when we think like that, it's easy to walk past Jesus. But this woman has no such illusions. Her dreams evaporated long ago. And so she immediately says to Jesus, "Sir, give me this water so that I won't get thirsty and have to keep coming here to draw water." Still a note of playfulness. But Jesus knows he's touched a chord, and he presses on. "Go, call your husband." She replies, "I have no husband." He says, "You're right. You've had five, and the man you're now living with is not your husband." What is Jesus doing? Is he trying to humiliate her? No. If that were so, he would never have begun the conversation in the first place. Rather, he's prompting her. If you want to understand this living water I offer, you'll need to see that you've been looking for it in the wrong place. Your need for men is eating you alive. And it's not working, is it? At this point, shocked by Jesus' knowledge of her life, she replies, "Sir, I see you are a prophet." And then she raises one of the great theological disputes of the day. Our fathers worshipped on this mountain, but you Jews claim that the place where we must worship is in Jerusalem. And Jesus' reply is saying, there's a time coming when there'll be no need for a physical temple to access God. A new era is coming. And then it will be a matter of worshipping God in spirit and in truth. What does Jesus mean? He says God is spirit. He's not limited to one particular place. So where you worship God does not matter. People sometimes think that what Jesus is saying here is that modern idea that it doesn't matter what you believe as long as you're sincere. But that is a misunderstanding of what Jesus says. When he speaks of worshipping in spirit, he's talking about that inner gift of spiritual life that he's offering. And when he talks about the truth, that's not just a reference to sincerity. It's the truth about God, which he is now making visible. He's not saying that everybody can worship God in their own way. He's actually saying it's only through the spiritual life that he is bringing that true worship, true encounter with God can happen. Somewhat overwhelmed, the woman says, verse 25, "I know that Messiah is coming. When he comes, he will explain everything to us." And then Jesus drops his bombshell. "I who speak to you am he." And that means that this eternal life, this living water that satisfies our deepest need, that is the secret of true happiness, true contentment, is not another possession, but a person. The answer to our inmost need is a relationship with him, the living one. That's his invitation to this woman and to each one of us. Do you see the effect this has upon her? Verse 28, leaving her water jar. John is the master of such apparently incidental details. Leaving the symbol of her emptiness, abandoned at his feet, she has found the living water. She's found Jesus. And now, instead of avoiding her neighbors out of shame, she goes to tell them about the living water, the thirst quencher she has just met. How did this woman find salvation? It was because Jesus was thirsty. If he had not been thirsty, he would not have gone to the well, and she would not have found the living water. And why was Jesus thirsty? Because the divine Son of God, who emptied himself of his glory and entered his world as a human being, vulnerable to being thirsty and weary, she found the living water because Jesus said, "I'm thirsty." This is not the only time that Jesus says, "I thirst," in John's Gospel. Just before he dies on the cross, he said, "I thirst." And that was more than physical thirst. You see, there, Jesus was experiencing loss of relationship with his Father. He was cut off from his Father. He was experiencing ultimate, cosmic, eternal thirst because he was taking the punishment we deserve. Do you see the wonder of it? It is because Jesus experienced cosmic thirst on the cross that in him, you and I can have our own spiritual thirst satisfied. remembering that, rejoicing in such love, will turn our hearts away from the things that enslave us and turn our hearts instead to Him, the one who alone satisfies our deepest need. Perhaps for someone this morning, as we followed this conversation, you've begun to realize that your inner emptiness as never before, that you can't go on any longer trying to fulfill it with things from the outside, because actually that moral failure we all share, which has cut you off from the life of God and left you with that inner emptiness, Jesus is inviting you to come to Him. Come to Me, realizing who I am, and ask Me for that living water of God's forgiveness, God's welcome, God's presence. Let us pray.